It's scary. See, that to me, that's what it comes down to. It is bloody scary how super brilliant Kubrick obviously was. To me, it can't even be a human intelligence. I mean, it's got to come from.
But not to hammer this over the head, if you didn't know the algorithms to the simple puzzle of Rubik's Cube, and someone solved that in front of you, you would think they were some sort of mega genius.
No, I wouldn't agree with that, Bill. I mean, I definitely exist in a hinterland in that area. I'm a person who can learn things. I can be taught things. I can discover things. And I'm aware of that fact. And I'm not so totally blown away by mysterious processes that seem temporarily out of reach to me. And I don't necessarily see them as being strictly magical. But there's something about the deftness, the dexterity, maybe inhuman intelligence is the wrong way of putting it, but to me, the genius of Kubrick is so profound, I can't find anything else that even comes close to it.
Finnegan's Wake and James Joyce.
I would agree. Finnegan's Wake is a good example of that, yeah.
And McLuhan spent his time studying Joyce and the Wake. And Kubrick spent his time studying McLuhan as well as Joyce. I mean, the opening shot of The Shining is the first sentence of Finnegan's Wake. Mm. River run past Even Adams brings us by a commodious vicus of recirculation to Howth Castle and environs.
Yeah, I mean, totally.
You open up on the water, the winding path, you throw a toilet in there, and then you've got the castle. I mean, it's just explicit. And he's telling you that you're going to be swirling in this dream language that tells you more about reality than reality or something like that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's extraordinary. And I guess that's what I'm getting at. And I would say the same thing about Joyce. You know, we bandy the words genius and intelligence around much too easily, I think, in this world. Intelligence is one thing, but to me, genius is something that I find a little bit frightening, essentially, because I don't have a direct access to that kind of creative power, and it just blows me away. Being blown away by it, I literally feel almost like I feel awestruck, like I'm in the presence of some kind of god. So I don't want to overplay that. I'm not... You know, I don't worship Stanley Kubrick or the likes of I don't think I worship anything. I don't know. Maybe I do. But just the experience, the proximity to this kind of genius, you know, there's the expression the devil is in the details. And I quite frankly, I think that sums it up perfectly. When you're looking at a Kubrick film, the only other artist that I think could be deservedly compared to Kubrick is Leonardo da Vinci, quite frankly. You know, that might be a bit hyperbolic, but I think it's true. The mysteries of Kubrick are so deep, they're so profound, that the intelligence seems to me a practically impossible. The energy, the intelligence, the vitality, the depth, and the dexterity. I could go on about this forever. It just, it literally knocks my socks off. You know, when I saw the movie Eyes Wide Shut, could somebody mute their mic? I've got a really big feedback going. When I saw Eyes Wide Shut for the first time, I really hated it, basically. I thought to myself, oh, Jesus, what the hell is it? You know, from my beloved Stanley Kubrick, I was very angry, because pretty much every Kubrick film that I'd ever seen before seeing Eyes Wide Shut had completely transformed me in some sense almost. And with Eyes Wide Shut, I'm just sitting there thinking, what the fuck is that? You know, what the fuck is that? The movie is actually boring. Kubrick dares to be boring. And he does it on purpose. You know, let me give you an example of this. In the first scene where Alice is in the loo and she's saying, you know, you're not even looking at me. Kubrick is talking about the film. He already knows he's giving you something so far outside of what you ever expected from him. He's doing it on purpose. He's making fun of you in ways so subtle you won't notice it without literally devoting your life almost to the study of his work.
Well, Alice is the film.
What's that?
She's the embodiment of the film, just as the Shekinah is the embodiment of the Torah.
Yeah.
And then the later scene, she's in front of it, of this whole entertainment center thing, directly in front of it, like the monolith. So it's like Alice is the monolith, and thus is the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep, that's it in a nutshell. And but the fact that he would, you know, it would be an interesting discussion to have sometimes to talk about the sync-ups. I know this is such a controversial matter between Eyes Wide Shut and certain pieces of music, and Kubrick's films and certain pieces of music in general, because there's a line in the song, the very first song on The Wall, and I am completely certain that without a single doubt in my mind, I could literally stand in front of a firing squad and I wouldn't even break a sweat on this. I believe without a doubt that Kubrick timed the movie Eyes Wide Shut to be watched while listening to the album The Wall. And, you know, you can go ahead and do this for yourself. It is an extraordinary thing. You might not believe it right away, but there are certain occurrences that are almost beyond impossible, that it was not a pre-programmed thing. At least I think that.
It's a stunner. I agree with you, Mark, and we both know that we agree.
Yeah, yeah, it is beyond stunning.
It's a chemical bath that reveals so much complexity. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous thing to do, and very simple to do as well.
Yeah, it is. It is easy, and you know, the depth of it is extraordinary. I won't even begin to get into that, but right at the opening of the film, the first song, the first lyrical part of the song, which is called In the Flesh, the line is, if you want to find out what's behind these cold eyes, you'll just have to tear your way through this disguise. And believing as I do that Kubrick is again, he's telling us who he is. He's just laying it right out there in front of you. You want to know me, you're going to have to dig and dig and dig and dig and dig to find out what I'm really, really about. And when you finally get there, you're probably not going to like it very much, basically. And to me, this is the real mystery of Eyes Wide Shut, is a revelation of Kubrick's personality himself. And, you know, it's something that I don't – well, yeah, maybe God's apology. I don't know if it's an apology, though, but it could be. It could be. Because there, you know, the funny thing is, Eyes Wide Shut, if you see this film, the fact is Kubrick was making a movie for people who watched his movies. That's what he was doing. This is an extraordinary, bold thing to do. He did not give a fuck what anyone thought of this film, except for people who watched his film.
I agree with
and
that.
He was throwing down a brutal gauntlet to those people. And you know, when I finally started to cue in, and it took me years to cue into Eyes Wide Shut, I realized he was saying, you know what? You've been watching my films and you've been talking about them like you have some idea what they're about, and you just don't have a fucking clue, buddy. That's what Eyes Wide Shut is saying to you. You don't have a clue. You've never had a clue. Pay the fuck attention to what I've been telling you all along. You're not paying attention at all. You think that there's this, that I'm all about this or I'm all about that, that I'm exploring. You don't have a clue, buddy. You want to know, it's in this movie, but you're probably not going to like it. And it's right there. It's there in so many ways in the film. You know, in the note that Dr. Bill receives when he goes to Somerton Estates, you know, give up your inquiries, which are totally useless, you know, and probably dangerous. And, and of course, when Ziegler, which means bricklayer, of course, you know, says, you know, if you knew the truth about this, you probably wouldn't sleep as well anymore, basically. But, and this is my struggle with Kubrick, Mein Kampf with Kubrick, if you enjoy the German translation. My struggle with Kubrick is that, you know, how dare he fuck with my head that much, that my life is almost a kind of a shambles where I try to understand everything in terms of how it relates to a Stanley Kubrick movie. You know, I have to laugh at it, in a sense. It makes me – Stanley Kubrick has made a fool out of me, basically. And that's how I feel about his films. And I love him for it, but I also hate him for it, for making a fool out of me, basically. So,
but can I ask, is the idea that he inserted in there all the truth as he know it, Is this sort of like Jay Widener point of view of like he's sneaking in the secret truth, or is he literally just fucking with your head? Is he the Joker? Is he the private Joker? And be like, all right, you want a fucking mystery here? I'm gonna give you a bunch of red herrings and, you know, have some fun with this. Mm. I'm on my way out. Well, I'm checking out.
Really glad you brought up that whole thing about red herrings, because right after we finished our discussion, I was planning on making a short video about the concept of the red herring. And, you know, 2001 is the ultimate red herring movie, because it takes the concept of an object that has no meaning, essentially, and it drives the plot. But what it also does for the red herring is it elevates it to the level where now it's not just something that's meaningless. Now, instead of the red herring simply driving the story to reveal aspects of the character, the red herring is literally the center of the story itself. It becomes the entire meaning of the film. It becomes the entire meaning of reality. And to me, that fits a lot in with the, to slide into philosophy, the concept of John Baudrillard, you know, that we're living in a kind of a simulation, basically, or a puzzle box.
Right, and it does, but it doesn't have to be a red herring. It could be, you know, like the Pulp Fiction, you never see what's in the suitcase. But it doesn't have to be like, because it's a puzzle to be unlocked, but the fact that it's a sort of fucking Zen koan, it's this idea of like, it doesn't have an answer. There's no single truth to what it is. It's a fucking metaphor. It's like, this is a meditative tool to try and find the answer for what it is a foolish quest, perhaps.
Yeah, well, but it really does take, because the original concept of the red herring in storytelling it doesn't have any meaning whatsoever, the item. And the Pulp Fiction briefcase is something like that. You know, you can speculate on the meaning of what is in the Pulp Fiction briefcase, but it doesn't really change the content of the story at all. It could be almost anything, essentially. And in that way, Pulp Fiction is a weaker film than, say, a much weaker film than 2001, because what he's done. And, you know, by the way, just so you guys know, as lovers of Kubrick in general, the movie 2001 is a joke. It's a pun. It's a very simple pun on three words, which is Deus Ex Machina, basically. Yeah. The entire film is just a pun on that. That's all it is. He's just making a pun on Deus Ex Machina. And if you're aware of the concept of Deus Ex Machina, you'll remember that in the early Greek theater, Deus Ex Machina was considered to be considered to be a failure by the director. It was considered to be a failure by the writer. If they had to bring in a Deus Ex Machina, if they had to bring in some kind of mechanism to explain the story and to give motivation to the characters, then by the code of Greek playwriting, it was considered a bad piece of work. So Deus Ex Machina was literally proposed as a criticism of a bad piece of work. And this is what Kubrick has done, is he's taken this idea of some kind of meaningless work, something that is entirely without any objective value whatsoever, and he's elevated it to a level where we're all running around going, scratching our heads, going, oh my God, what does this mean? What does that mean? And but the real beauty of it is it does have meaning. That's the thing. There is meaning there. The lines do, in my opinion, start to converge at a certain point, somewhere, you know, circling the planet Saturn right now on the moon called Iapetus. Something is happening that does have meaning, that's going to affect reality in a way that kind of blows the whole, you know, cause and effect concept of infinite regression out of the water, I think. And we'll have to see about that, obviously. But there you have it. That's just my view.
Are you talking about an actual event in our quote-unquote reality?
Yes, yeah, I am, yeah. And I, according to Kubrick, it should happen next year.
Are you referring to the sort of Project Lucifer idea or something else?
Yes and no. Yes and no. Because I'm not sure about the whole Lucifer Project thing. But in my opinion, this is going to be something on the level of a biblical apocalypse. And I don't ascribe to any religious beliefs myself in terms of whether or not I, say, have a spiritual solace or whether or not I pray to any God or anything like that. I want to make that clear. But we talked very early in our conversation about, at the beginning of The Shining, how the term, how the musical terminology of the Day of Wrath or the Day of Judgment is. And that's ultimately what I think it is that it's a kind of an, it's going to be an end of time type of event, similar to a judgment, basically. And I don't believe that it's going to be elusive or metaphorical. It's going to be something that is easily understood by everybody.
So is this something you're willing to talk? I'm curious what.
People have been fighting signs of the apocalypse and lots of things. It's strange that you would then go from, say, the traditional finding it in the Bible to finding it in Kubrick films. And yeah, this is the first I've heard of this.
Yeah, I'm curious if you'd expand upon this idea.
Well, I couldn't quite hear what Jason was saying. Could somebody other than him kind of repeat it? Because he's coming in a bit fuzzy.
I believe he was saying that it's funny that, you know, these things are found in the Bible. It's funny that you're finding them in a Kubrick film, that he had never heard of this specific thing that you're talking about.
Oh, yeah. No, this idea of the 2013 kind of end of time prophecy relating to directly to the Catholic song, the Dies Irae song, relates it all into the so-called Christian or the biblical judgment, essentially. So it's definitely there, in my opinion. Does that kind of clarify it, or like, are you looking for?
If you're talking something metaphorical, then we could say, okay, 2013. It's Tommy just wrote 20 is the judgment card in the tarot. 13 is death. So we have judgment. We have death. We have all this stuff. We want to play it as something metaphor, but you're saying not a metaphor. You're saying something specific that you think is on,
yes, I
on
do,
this
yeah.
moon of Iapetus.
Because,
so I'm asking, what do you think is there? What have you?
I wouldn't speculate on that. I've come across some speculation on that, and it's quite interesting, basically. You'd have to take your time and do some in-depth research, because if I start talking about it in specific, it would probably seem silly. I'd sound a little bit like a crackpot. It takes a lot of time to put it all together. There's a great deal to it.
Well, I've okay, so where did we get cut off? That was pretty fucking interesting.
Well, you were starting to ask me exactly what I thought the nature of the Iapetus mystery might be.
Yeah, so, I mean, like I said, I've read different theories about some of the probes that they've sent over Saturn that are loaded with plutonium. This is the idea of sort of igniting something. Are we talking about an ignition, or are we talking about something unrelated to that?
Well, okay, all right. I'm going to sketch out the main theory about Iapetus. Obviously, it might sound a little bit crackpotish, but when you really delve into it,
Can everyone else mute their mics for a second? I'm getting a weird feedback here. Go ahead.
All right, shall I continue? Okay, so you could start, say, by going fairly deeply into Jay Widener. He talks about it a bit. There's a lot of people, particularly Christian apocalypse, that are talking about it right now as well. Now, basically, what is it, when you combine the myth of Iapetus with a variety of different sources. And I mean, you know, it would be a synchronistic sort of article, basically. It would almost have to be a Jake Kotze type exploration of a theme to really hone in, or at least to satisfy you guys that there's something there. Okay, so, and obviously I can't reel all of that off right now, but I've done enough research certainly to compile such an article myself. And basically is that there's something trapped inside the planet Iapetus, that it's actually an artificial structure that contains some sort of virus, essentially, or a plague that will be released on the world at a certain period of time. And this fits in with the concept of the Day of Wrath and the judgment or the apocalypse of St. John and other things like that. So, and all of that ties in to Kubrick because in the original 2001 novel, which was written in coordination, you know, you guys all know that there's at least a myth that that Kubrick wanted to stage the finale of 2001 near Saturn as opposed to near Jupiter, right?
Yeah.
But that the story goes that Saturn was too difficult to fabricate in the studio, so they, and of course the term Jupiter and beyond the infinite sort of gets to that point. And I guess in terms of this, the concept of the event that I'm talking about that is sort of implied by The Shining, which is this judgment, really what we're talking about is a break in infinite regression or cyclical time, where time is going to come to a so-called end, essentially, a precipice or a linear conclusion. And of course, that would provide essentially an objective viewpoint of reality as opposed to a continually fractalated one. But so Kubrick wanted to stage the end of 2001 supposedly near Saturn. And of course, in the novel 2001, the room that that David Bowman is confined at is apparently on the satellite of Saturn called Iapetus. Okay, so this concept of being confined for a period of time before being unleashed on the Earth is present both in the myth of Iapetus, and then finally through a series of investigations that would be suitable for a secret mystic article, basically. There was a TV series called Revelations with Bill Pullman a while back. It was only 6 episodes long, and it I didn't see it myself, but it deals with the planet Iapetus, and it implies that at the time of judgment, something is going to be unleashed from Iapetus, basically. So that's what I'm saying that the Shining, that this 2013 message in The Shining is about, is that the mystery, the apparent mystery of Kubrick's work, particularly 2001, is the problem of infinite regression, right? And when we're talking about the establishment of authority here, now, as I said earlier, you know, Kubrick identifies himself as or he appears to self-identify as Satan or Saturn. So, and of course, this would stand in for God, right? So God would be an objective authority, essentially. And for there to be an objective reality, time must be linear. This is it's an absolute conclusion of philosophy. You can't escape it. So what I'm implying is that The Shining is a movie about the end of time, basically. And this 2013 clue fits in with this idea of Iapetus essentially opening up to unleash a state of judgment and therefore authoritative objectivity over reality.
No,
does that mean?
But time never ends at the end of The Shining. The Overlook is always there, and it's always 1921. The party just keeps on going at the end. TikTok, but the party don't stop.
you know, Bill and I were talking on Tuesday. We did 42 minutes. We were talking about this idea that everything, you know, everything now kind of looks the same. So all the cars look the same. A lot of the music sounds the same. That things aren't, you know, are harder to pinpoint to a specific era in time, that something from the 1920s looks like it's from the 1920s, something from the 1950s looks like it's from the 1950s. And the idea was, what does ours look like? It's a kind of mishmash. And I realized after the call that this seems like Terrence McKenna's sort of end of time, the idea that sort of this novelty factor where it's harder to tell what you know, make the distinctions would sort of seem maybe in line with this, not so much as a, again, not as a literal thing, but as a, it's getting harder to make these distinctions.
Well, that would all fit in with, go ahead, Jason.
It occurs to me that the 1921 ball is sort of a timeless state as much as it occurred before the advent of sound film and then color film after that, which would represent successive stages of creation from an original silent state to the utterance of the word or the introduction of sound and then the division in colors. If we take this as being Kubrick's wink as to the history of cinema, but I don't know, just anyway, continue.
Well, no. That's very interesting, Jason, because I agree with you. This idea of the way in which our media progresses almost seems to mirror consciousness as it expands, essentially. And the writer Mastermind, who writes about The Shining, basically proposes that what Kubrick is doing is creating a new language, essentially. He's trying to completely formulate a new language. Well, if that's true, if what Kubrick is doing is using visual imagery and different things like neurolinguistic programming, you know, the use of puns and double meanings in words, spoken words, and also double meanings in letter forms as well, etc. If he's doing this, if he's actually creating a new language, and it seems to me that in a certain sense that even if he might not be the source of this language, that he is certainly appears to be stating some kind of new language. A new language would essentially be a new logos, right? A new word. And that new word would be the establishment of some kind of authority figure, right? So it would be, in a sense, the resurrection of God into the world. And by God, I mean, it would be the awareness of every person who was alive that there was a single central authoritative principle that was holding everything together. That's just my idea about this, the way all this works. Tying into the idea that Kubrick was expressing things in a new language, basically.
Wouldn't new language be kind of mirrored in the rhyme slang of certain parts of England, or just very, very heavy dialects of common language that you don't really know exist until you are confronted with them? And then when you're confronted with them, you have to ask yourself, are these people speaking English or what language is this? And it might be just a very, very far off offshoot of a very common language. So we can tell that this language creation occurs in very, very niche, very concentrated areas, more likely neighborhoods. But if you could get that kind of language transformation on a global scale, then maybe you could find this resurrection of this king of logos. So I'm thinking with Kubrick and his films and his body of work, because they are global, because they are in every continent of the globe, and because people seem to be just as obsessed about them in America as they are in England, as they are in South America, perhaps, that maybe he's trying to draw a niche community together which will translate this new language and bring it out into the public.
This comes back to Mark's idea of Eyes Wide Shut being a movie made for Kubrick fans. When's the last time anybody watched The Killing?
I watched it about 3 weeks ago.
A few months ago.
What's that?
I haven't seen that one in a while.
What's The Killing?
The Killing is a Stanley Kubrick movie about gambling and horse races. And the idea that last week on Always Record we were talking about gambling. This week, I believe Mark brought it up again. And then in this page 133 from The Catcher in the Rye that Wendy's reading, we see that he says, there's always a dumb horse race and some dame breaking a bottle over a ship and some chimpanzee riding a goddamn bicycle with pants on. So I feel like the horse race came back up. I was just curious if anybody had seen it recently, if there's a sink that it's not a knot that's not obvious here.
Wow, that's it's actually pretty profound. I mean, it wouldn't be difficult to extrapolate the entire film of The Killing from that phrase, a dame breaking a bottle. I mean, just the use of the word dame itself fits in so nicely into the world of The Killing. And it's a woman who brings down the mission, basically. It's a treacherous woman who causes the plan to rob the horse race to go awry, essentially. I'd like to see the movie again to see if there's any references to monkeys in there. But, John, just to bring you up to date, earlier we were talking about in the scene in The Shining where Wendy, when we first meet Wendy and Danny, and she's sitting at the kitchen table reading Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
Yeah, the page number of the book that she's reading is page 133. So it's open to page 133. So if you wanted to check that out for yourself, it's got some very interesting text in there.
Yeah, I'll have to take a trip to the library if you don't have a copy of the book anymore.
Well,
it contains it.
It kind of reminds me of the part in was it Good Day for Banana Fish? Where the banana fish's main problem is that it goes into a hole to get something to eat and then can't get out again. Kind of reminds me of Wendy and Danny's problem in the bathroom of not being able to fit through the hole.
Hey.
That is a very interesting analogy.
John, now that you're on the line, we can ask you. In the Shining, there's references. The one that stands out in my mind is when it says Wednesday, the title card that says Wednesday. What other days are pinpointed, and have you made any correlations with those?
All days of the week except for Friday and Sunday are represented. So I figured that was like some sort of Christ denied thing or something like that. Yeah, some sort of cheap dime store Anton LaVey style Satanism. And the days of the week, it starts on Tuesday, I believe, and then. Yeah, Tuesday, and then skips every other day until you get to Wednesday. And then action continues through Wednesday, Thursday, and then maybe a little bit of Friday morning or something.
But as far as the title cards, you do see a title card for every day except for Friday and Sunday?
Yeah, but so it's Tuesday. It'd be Tuesday, Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, Monday, Wednesday.
Oh, interesting. So...
Yeah. And it's like the center of the movie takes place on Wednesday. It's the center of the week, you know. And then there's that whole strange "see you next Wednesday" joke that's in 2001.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know, which is a play on "see you next Tuesday," which if you spell it out, you know, spells a fun word. And then John Landis goes on that whole "see you next Wednesday" inside joke in all his movies, having that.
Wait, what is "see you next Tuesday" spell out?
C-U-N-T.
Okay.
So see you next Wednesday. It's like Kubrick has this joke that's where you just do the one next. The poster and in between the two twins, the date is 1922, which is like one after 1921, and the dartboard, the black and white. The black and white has 41 possible scores, and the color parts have 42 possible scores. Instead of this weird one, plus one that he seems to inject into this patterns.
Interesting. Well, what are the things?
You know, combined with schoolboy, sexist humor.
Right. One of the things we noticed was that I made the connection that. Wendy gets into the snow cat, and there's two snow cats. On the chariot cart of the Tarot, it's being pulled by the two sphinxes, the two feline sphinxes. But it's also the goddess of Friday, the Norse goddess of Friday, has a chariot that's pulled by two cats. So I was connecting Wendy with the goddess of Friday, because I was thinking of these different days of the week. So I was curious if there was something there. So that the fact that Friday is missing, and also the sun day is missing. So it's like,
yeah, well, they the well then the mother and the son are missing from the
exactly.
eventually missing from the story.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Awesome.
Awesome.
Yeah, like Julie Kearns. I don't know if you're familiar. Like she goes really in deep with this, the sphinxes, and connects them to the sphincter. And then we were kind of riffing on like all the different Sphinx characters and Kubrick, like, and connecting it to kind of like Ullman's strange hands. You know, he's got those praying hands, and Alan Cumming's character in Eyes Wide Shut has the same kind of like paw-like hands, and like is behind a desk, so you can't see their legs, so it looks like that they're a Sphinx. Hello.
Yes.
And you know, Alan Cumming. If you,
I am
if
right
you
now.
Look outside. Well, if you look outside, good for you. I mean, all the more power to you, as Crowley would probably say. But if you look outside the window, when Alan Cumming is having it, when I call him the kinky desk clerk, I don't know what he's called in the credits, but. When you look out across the street, you can see through the open window in front of the hotel. The letters ASS, A-S-S, are written right there. And what's interesting about that is that... I was going to make a pun on, you know, Alan being anal, right? So you can... So it becomes anal coming, essentially. And that gets right into the concept of Julie Kearns' idea of the sphincter as well.
So you're fantastic.
My name is sure. My name is Green Anus.
But also the hotel, it's the Hotel Jason, but the when you see the sign that the N is missing, which relates of course to the lack of north in the EWS glyph.
Yeah, who was talking about that, the EWS thing? Hello.
Sorry, I'm reading page 132 in The Catcher in the Rye, because it occurred to me that you can see page 133, but what's on the other side that you can't see? And I thought it was interesting that because you can't, that's all. In the first place, we're both practically children, children's italicized. And didn't you ever stop to think what you'd do if you didn't get a job when your money ran out? We'd starve to death. I just think that's kind of funny.
Right, that fits in with the whole concept of the Donner
exactly.
Party, right? Having to cannibalize themselves out there in the frozen wilderness. And, I'm sorry, I lost my thought there. Somebody take up some slack here.
Well, you know, the whole thing about Danny's knowledge of the Donner Party, he learned it on the television. If a child, you could, as adults, if you wanted to reference the Donner Party, you could say that in casual conversation, and it would never penetrate the consciousness of a child. It wouldn't really stick out to them. And so as adults, you could reference that sort of domain of human capability or human history. It could just remain very quietly an adult conversation. But this television that has invaded the bookshelves of the Torrance family is just lasering in very adult and very explicit fragments of the human condition. These are fragments of the human condition that would only enter into Danny's mind in a very extreme and very specific occasion. He would have to walk up upon a family engaged in cannibalism, or he'd have to hear...
This was the mystery that they witnessed on the television. The mystery is the mystery of the Eucharist, which they first witnessed in this controlled environment of the television set as something that they don't immediately see is going to apply to themselves once they enter the Overlook and do have to symbolically devour themselves, which goes against the bear and all of the eating symbolism in that film.
I like that.
And then, of course, when Jack's girl ties in with Alan Cumming in Eyes Wide Shut, and now once Tom Cruise has crossed the abyss, I come out on the other side, he had become a little bit fruity, having now integrated the feminine aspect of his psyche and learned how to fuck himself. Anyway, continue.
Go fuck yourself. Great advice.
If you wish.
I've always kind of been partial to calling myself up on the phone and asking myself out. You know? Oh, yeah, you call yourself up too, huh? Yeah. Now, one thing about it, you're always around. Yeah, I know. Yeah, you ask yourself out, you know. Some class joint somewhere. The Burrito King or something. You know, well, I ain't cheap, you know. Take yourself out for a couple of drinks, maybe, you know. Then you'd be some provocative conversation on the way home. And park in front of the house, you know. You smooth, you know, you put a little nice music on. Maybe you put on like, you know, like shopping music, something that's not too interruptive, you know, and then, you know, and slide over real nice, you know. Say, oh, I think you have something in your eye. Well, maybe it's not that romantic with you, but Christ, you know, get into it, you know. Take myself up to the porch and take myself inside, or maybe get a little something in a brandy snifter or something. Would you like to listen to some of my back records? I got something here. Well, usually about 2:30 in the morning, you've ended up taking advantage of yourself, and there ain't no way around that, you know. Yeah, making a scene with a magazine, there ain't no way around. I'll confess, you know, I'm no different, you know. I'm not weird about it or anything. I don't tie myself up first. I just, you know, I just kind of spend a little time with myself.